average bounce meter for your Midnight Marauder program will be in the area of 95 BPM. We hope that you will find our presentation precise, bass heavy, and just right. Thanks.
Hello, I'm Neil Allen from Hudson, New York. You're listening to WGXE Acra 90.7 FM.
You're listening to Zach Poff's Pond Station, available at wavefarm.org/listen. If you click on the listen button on any WGXC.org page, you can hear the sounds from the bottom of one of the Wave Farm ponds, thanks to the hydrophones Zach Poff has put there. The radio artist is surveilling the underwater sounds in Greene County, and you can go to wavefarm.org/listen or click on any WGXC.org page and click on the listen button to listen to transmissions from inside a Wave Farm pond from morning until sundown from Zach Poff's pond station.
From Survival comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just a weekend.
Get maximum protection from nuclear fallout for your family.
See a Survival shelter today.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Teo Campo-Real of Athens, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Give me liberty, or give me death!
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
Welcome to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV that features inspiring conversations with activists, community leaders, and others working to make our world a better place. I'm Maeve Conran, and on today's show, Attica. 50 years ago, inmates in Attica, a maximum security prison in upstate New York, held an uprising to protest dehumanizing prison conditions. A bloody crackdown by state police left 39 dead. Attica paved the way for the modern anti-prison movement. Today, we're joined by Tyrone Larkins, one of the Attica survivors, and Sophia Elijah, Executive Director of Alliance of Families for Justice, a group that's working to change the landscape of injustice in American courts and prisons. From Free Speech TV, Just Solutions. Tyrone, you were there in Attica 50 years ago. You were a young man. You were in your early 20s. Take us through what conditions were like.
Oh, God. Attica in 1971 was one of the most, if not the most secure prison in New York State. Coupled with it being the most secure prison in New York State, referring to the bars and the walls, it was also one of the most brutal prisons in New York State. Correction officers didn't speak to you. They didn't speak at you. And the basic ways of communicating with men or men confined was the banging on the of their clubs on the wall. Two hits on the wall means stop. One hit on the wall means go. And there was a very hard lack of communication between prisoners and the people that kept the prisoners in prison itself. the racial dynamics was very important to realize that Attica is located in one of the rural parts of the state of New York, Wyoming County, New York, western part of New York State. And the majority of the people that was confined there were people of color that came from basically the urban centers of New York State itself. So you had a dichotomy and an antithesis, I guess you can say, regarding the kept and the keeper.
I think that's such an important point that's so relevant to the current prison industrial complex that we'll talk about in just a moment. But getting back to 1971, you were transferred to Attica in January of that year. And 9 months later is when the rebellion happened. And I know there was severe overcrowding. Many, many more people were incarcerated there than the prison had been designed for. There was very, very bad living conditions, poor food, restricted access to family visits, many more issues that were being raised. But also this was happening while there was a very large civil rights movement happening outside of the prison. What was the connection between the two, the civil rights that were happening outside and then prisoners' awareness about their own living conditions and their need to advocate for themselves?
Okay. We're going to the late 60s and early 70s. Throughout the United States, or I could say throughout the world, there was a large protest against the war in Vietnam. We had slogans like "Hell no, we won't go," and that basically referred to the Vietnam conflict that the United States was engaged in with North and South and South Vietnam, and we could say the racial overtones of people of color, particularly black people of color, being made aware of who they are. And we went by slogans, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Black is beautiful, as opposed to being recognized as Negroes in America. So that in itself, or those two factors itself, created a conflict between the keeper and the kept. As I said earlier, the keeper came from rural America, which basically was right-wing thinking, and everything in America was great, even the conflict in Vietnam, so forth, etc. And black people, as they seen them, were supposed to be called Negroes because this is what they was taught. But when you have a young man coming into the prison system that's saying, no, don't call me Negro no more, because that's being identified as a neo-slave, identifying me as a black person where my descendant is from Africa. And that created conflicts.
And that conflict between the keeper and the kept, as you frame it, Tyrone, that very much continued on when the rebellion actually happened. What was your sense of that? Was it organized? Was it something that was more spontaneous? Because I know there had been organized demands that were being made by prisoners before the rebellion. They were organizing themselves to say, these are the conditions that we need to have improved, but they weren't being met with any type of response. So do you have memories of that day of when the rebellion itself kicked off?
Yes. Basically, the rebellion was a spontaneous situation that happened actually started the night before on the 8th in housing block A in that yard. And it came about because two individuals was horsing around in the yard, and ironically one was black and the other one was white, and it was no real conflict, nothing serious. It was guys practicing football, and the prison guards didn't like that. They told them to break it up, and the guys refused, and the guys was locked up. Later on that night, the prison guards took them out of their cell and beat them and took them to a segregation unit within the prison itself. The next day, on the 9th, the morning of September 9th, when it all started. I happened to be working in the prison industrial area, the metal shop. And the first thing I heard about 9:30, somewhere in that half an hour frame, I heard the emergency whistle or the emergency horns in the prison going off. And the only time I've ever heard that in the past was when somebody escaped out the prison. So my first reaction was that somebody escaped or somebody was attempting to escape at that time. But a few minutes afterwards, I've seen guys come rushing into the metal shop who I haven't seen, or the only time I've ever seen them, rather, was in the facility mess hall, the chow hall, I should say. And when I seen them and I heard all the howling and screaming, I knew it was something that was out of whack. And we call it today a riot, a prison riot. And you know what? We all winded up, for the most part, prisoners anyway, into D Block Yard. And from that standpoint, while we was in D Block Yard, that's when the organizing started of how this whole situation was going to be handled with the powers that be.
I think that's such a great point to emphasize, that it was then an organized effort. After that initial rebellion, there were elected spokespeople, and that negotiators were called in, including civil rights attorney William Kunstler and some others. And there were several days of negotiations, but then there was a brutal crackdown ordered by then New York State Governor Rockefeller. And so what happened was the state guard, state police came in and shot so many people. It was the bloodiest uprising or quelling of an uprising in a prison in US history. You were shot too. Tyrone, take us back to that. What are your memories of that?
Well, you know what? Friday night, I believe, was the last time I seen Bill Kunstler. And to his credit, God bless the dead, and may he be with God as his spirit should be with him right now. He was a decent individual. He was a straight shooter. He came in into the prison yard as a negotiator for the prisoners. And he was a natural guy that talked down to earth with everybody, and he was good. And the last time I seen Bill Kunstler, I believe it was that Saturday night or Friday, Saturday night, I believe it was. And I heard him saying to somebody, I don't know, they're negotiating kind of hard with you guys and so forth, et cetera, which I really wasn't paying that much attention to at that point. Sunday night, there was like a gloom that came over the prison itself. A heavy mist started coming down. It was like, it wasn't a rain and it wasn't a drizzle. It was like a mist. And that lasted until that Monday morning, the 13th. And then Monday morning, I remember next in the morning, I heard a helicopter coming over the prison yard, over the prison itself. And it came over the yard once, didn't say nothing. Nothing was being said. And then the second time it came over, there was an announcement coming from the helicopter. Before the announcement was made, a heavy gas came out of the helicopter. This gas was so strong, it literally knocked me to my knees when I inhaled it. And it cleaned up my whole sinuses, and it kept me in such a perpetual state of laying down. I couldn't like really get up off the ground. And then the announcement came, lay down on the ground, put your hands on your head, and you will not be harmed. Well, you know what? The same time that announcement was being made, I seen the ground around me shake and jump. And it only took me a matter of seconds to realize that gunshots was being fired in the yard and fired at me. And the first two times I was hit, and I was shot kind of bad. Laying down, I was still trying to figure out, how did I get shot in my foot and my leg at the same time, and in my hands, which was on top of my head? And that was on the 13th of September, 1971. And National Guard's corpsman pulled me out the yard, took me out on the stretcher, and took me out of harm's way, if you could say, to a certain extent. And I was lined up on the side of the prison where the special housing unit was at. And when I got there, I seen maybe 40, 50 people in stretchers that was in similar situations such as I was. Come to find out after the fact that 39 people was killed.
10 of those people were hostages. And the narrative that was put out by authorities was that those 10 hostages were killed by prisoners. That was a blatant lie. They were shot, and they were shot by the state authorities. Sophia Elijah, can you talk a little bit about the narrative that was put out after Attica in defense of this state-sanctioned violence and heavy-handed approach to criminalization? Because as I mentioned then, New York Governor Rockefeller, a lot of his decisions around this disproportionate response to the uprising, was around his own political ambitions and this tough on crime attitude. And that has actually been a huge part of politics. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So Governor Rockefeller had aspirations to be president, and he was in constant communication with then President Nixon about how he was handling or mishandling the situation in Attica. And immediately after he ordered the violent retaking of the prison, working along with the media, put out a narrative saying that the men in Attica had murdered the hostages. In fact, said that they had slit the hostages' throats. And that was the story that the media ran with for quite some time, until the courageous coroner reported that, in fact, the cause of death for all of the people who had died was from gunshot wounds, and none of them had had their throat slit. And it was quite some time before the general public would accept the truth that the coroner was brave enough to report. But in the meantime, quite a few of the men who had been in the yard were indicted by the state and faced criminal and murder charges, and were tried before they were eventually acquitted. And then they brought civil suits against the state, and the state dragged out those suits for many, many years before any justice was done for the Attica brothers.
You're listening to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV, featuring inspiring conversations with activists, community leaders, and others working to make our world a better place. Today, we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Attica Uprising, something that sparked the modern anti-prison movement. Our guests are Tyrone Larkins, who survived Attica, and Sophia Elijah, Executive Director of Alliance of Families for Justice, a group that supports families of incarcerated people and people with criminal records.
Well, Sophia, the organization that you're the executive director of, and you are a longtime human rights attorney, you've been involved in prison reform, prison abolition for many, many years. The Alliance of Families for Justice, you advocate on behalf of prisoners, but you also shine a light on the prison industrial complex and its impact on society. Mm-hmm. The demands back then by the prisoners, they're still so relevant to what we hear today: inadequate food, overcrowding, lack of access to proper family visits, the fact that these prisons are often located in rural areas that are relying heavily economically on the prison industrial complex. And as Tyrone made the point, then you have such a disparity between the prisoner and the prison guards. Has anything changed in terms of those demands that we heard from those prisoners in Attica? How much of those are still relevant today, those concerns?
I would say almost all of them are as relevant today as they were before. Right after the Attica Rebellion, for a short while, programming increased. Access to literature and educational opportunities increased for a brief while. But then the state's repressive hand came down hard. And what you find in most of the state's prisons today is very similar to the conditions that existed 50 years ago. Even through the dead heat of summer, there's no air conditioning in the prisons. In the winter, there's very, very little heat. Access to programs is difficult. Access to educational opportunities is limited. Brutality remains the same. The racism throughout the New York State prison system remains the same, and Attica is one of the most notorious places for that. So unfortunately, very little has changed, and that's why it is so important for people to remain vigilant to try to change this. And actually, we cannot reform the prison system. The only way to address this is to completely overhaul it, start from scratch, and come up with a better way to address people's needs instead of putting people in cages and suffering.
And how much is this connected to this political ideology that elected representatives, certainly when they're campaigning, have this tough on crime approach? We've seen this time and time again, certainly in New York, in New York City. We talked about that with then New York Governor Rockefeller. Are we still seeing that as part of our political narrative when it comes to prisons and when it comes to criminal justice?
You absolutely still see that. And part of the reason is because the guards union and the police unions are very, very powerful. And they put a lot of campaign money behind elected officials, people who are running for various offices, to try to secure their position and secure their jobs, even though the crime rate in New York State has dropped drastically and the prison population has dropped by over 40,000. The prison guards union still fights to make sure that prisons are not closed and that their jobs are secure. And you find the same thing with the police department throughout New York City and other parts of the state. So the political interests that underlie the pressure on elected officials cannot be ignored.
Let's talk about the economics of this. Tyrone brought this up, that Attica itself is located in upstate New York. Many of these large prisons are located in rural areas, that these communities are economically reliant. There are no other economic opportunities for folks in these communities. And that in and of itself is part of the problem when we look at the economics of warehousing these people in these rural areas. Sophia, I know this is part of the work that you're doing at Alliance of Families for Justice, is to raise awareness of some of these dynamics.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's important when we talk about the lack of economic alternatives in these rural communities. Well, the economic opportunities in the communities from which the people who are incarcerated come from are also very, very limited. But the narrative never seems to focus on the fact that those individuals don't have an opportunity to realize their dreams and to realize their potential. So the concern about economic opportunities has to cover all of the people who are affected by the prison industrial complex, not just the people who make a living off of running prisons and keeping people in cages.
Tyrone, what would you like people to know about what it is like to be incarcerated? Because very often when we talk about prison abolition or prison reform, this narrative emerges. Well, if people didn't commit crime, they wouldn't be in there in the first place. And that totally denies the humanity of people who are being incarcerated, let alone the racial inequity that we have in our incarceration system. What would you like people to know about what it means to be incarcerated in this country?
Interesting question, a very interesting question. And speaking for myself, I've made a metamorphosis after Attica. I had to do a lot of soul searching and questioning of how did I get here and what do I want the end result to be? Unfortunately, I did 29 years straight after Attica from the crime in which I was convicted of. And I was released in 1997. I came to prison in 1968, released in 1997, a total of 29 years. And within those 29 years, I had to do a lot of introspecting and asked myself the simple question, did I want my past to be my future? And I came to the conclusion, no. And I came up with an analysis of how to change myself. So the brutality of prison, what it did was make me stronger to a certain extent, not to be complacent or to accept the conditions of prison, just to bear with it and keep intact or keeping in touch with my mind to say, you know what, there's going to be a better day and a better way. So with that being said, the events that happened 50 years ago will always be part of me. And I would always say that, you know what, these conditions have to change for the generations that's coming after me.
Sophia, from the work that you have been doing around prison abolition over the years, what do you think is the biggest misconception that we have as a society about our current system of incarceration?
I think one of the things that the narrative around mass incarceration is missing is how it destroys whole communities. It destroys families, individuals, and communities. And we need healthy communities to have a healthy society. And unfortunately, because the concerns and the suffering of mostly Black and Brown people in this country are marginalized and swept under the rug, not enough attention has been placed on this issue. If you reverse the demographics of the prison industrial complex tomorrow, I can assure you that by Sunday it would be ended. And so we have to be vigilant and make sure that everybody understands that as a whole society, we all suffer by the damage that we're doing to the families, individuals, and their communities.
And of course, that racial component is undeniable when you look at the disproportionate number of Black and Brown people who are currently incarcerated. Tyrone, you said that being in prison gave you strength, but I've also heard you speak about the strength that you got to survive being in prison from your grandmother. Your grandmother was one generation away from slavery. When we talk about slavery, it's often in an abstract way. It's like that was so far in the past. That wasn't in the past, particularly when we're seeing ongoing racial injustice. Talk a little bit about that, about what that means to be so close to that, the strength that your grandmother gave you.
Sure. Well, take into account, and I'm sure universally it's accepted. I'm my grandmother's firstborn grandchild. From her firstborn child, which was my mother. So my grandmother's firstborn was a female, naturally, my mother. And her firstborn child, my mother, was a male. So historically, spiritually, and any other way you want to look at it, I was held into a certain reverence. And fortunately, my grandmother raised me and had a lot of influence over me. My grandmother told me certain things that she didn't tell her own children. And she told me as much because I would question her about certain things. And when I asked her about her mother one day, I remember I was a little boy and I said, Mama, how's your mama? Do you know your mama, Mama? And she stopped and she looked at me and she was trying to fight the tears away from her eyes. And she told me about the plantation that my great grandmother came from in Orangeburg, South Carolina. But it was up to her, my grandmother itself, to make a better way for her children and to make a better way for me. And, you know, the ironic part about it, I seen my grandmother do day's work in New York City. And some of your viewers may not know what that is. That's when Black women went to work in rich people houses, cleaning their houses, cooking for them, so forth, etc., for under the minimum wage. And my grandmother raised me, my children, and her children until a point of luck came our way when she had the ability with the help of my uncle and my mother to purchase a home in a different part of Brooklyn in 1957. And it wasn't so much of moving to a new neighborhood. that changed our attitudes. It was those things that was fostered in us from a child. And to give you an example, I remember my grandmother telling me about the big sickness in 1918, 1919. And I asked her about that. When she first came to New York City, she lived in Harlem. And she called it the big sickness at that time, 1918, 1919, 1920 plague. And ironically, that stuck with me until the pandemic that hit the world last year. And once again, having the fortitude of an elder in my family that had me the wherewithal to survive.
You've been listening to Just Solutions, a podcast from Free Speech TV. Today's guests were Tyrone Larkins, who survived the Attica prison uprising 50 years ago, and Sophia Elijah, Executive Director of Alliance of Families for Justice, a group that supports families of incarcerated people and people with criminal records. They're both involved in two events to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Attica uprising. They're happening in September. Find out more about those streaming events at atticaisallofus.org. And you can find out more about us and watch past episodes of Just Solutions at freespeech.org. Engage with us on social media, join the conversation, and let us know your thoughts at Free Speech TV. And subscribe to this podcast and never miss an episode. For Free Speech TV, Just Solutions, I'm Maeve Conran.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, incomes, debts, our own and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to begin today, as I have several programs in the past now, with signs, welcome, long overdue, of movement in the labor movement. So-called. In other words, real movement, real initiative, something to counter the long historical decline of organized labor here in the United States. This time I want to focus particularly on a strike by mine workers, miners, in the Warrior Met coal mine in Brookwood, Alabama. About 1,100 workers have been on strike there, members of the United Mine Workers of America, for several months. Toward the end of July, they came to New York City to protest in front of the offices of the BlackRock Asset Management Company, and I'll have more to say about that in a moment. Here's their concern. A few years ago, the coal company came out of bankruptcy, and as part of the bankruptcy emergence, they got all kinds of concessions from the workers to help the company get back on its feet. And let's really remember, all the decisions of the coal company are made by the board of directors, by the tiny number of people who sit at the top of that company. Their decisions waltzed that company into bankruptcy. But to get out of bankruptcy, they asked for, they needed, and they got concessions from the workers. The workers gave back some of what they had won in the past in wages, in working conditions. They helped fix the problems of the directors of that company, who had, of course, always excluded those workers from participating in the decisions until they messed it all up. And so the workers now say that the company, having made money, needs to compensate them for the concessions they made. Reasonable request, and the directors won't budge. It's the kind of fairness that passes for social justice in capitalism normally. And so the workers are determined not to accept it. That's the important thing. Where does BlackRock come in? BlackRock takes money from wealthy institutions, wealthy individuals, and manages it for them. BlackRock happens to be the largest single shareholder in the Warrior Met Coal Company. You know, that's how rich people get richer. They siphon off the profits made by people who have to go on strike for months. That's the way our system works. And so they were in New York, protesting in front of BlackRock. You might be interested to know that the leader of BlackRock, the CEO there, is Larry Fink, an ardent supporter of Donald Trump. It's not the only sign of labor militants. Here's a few more to give you a sense of how the world is changing. 17,000 teaching assistants and research assistants in the University of California system have come to join a union. They're moving to join a union and to get, finally, the pay, the recognition of their importance in that university, as TAs and RAs have that importance in every other. Then there's a vote to strike, a 98% vote of the workers to strike at a copper mine in Chile, the world's largest copper mine, and therefore a powerful shaper of that part of modern industry. And here's another sign of militants. More workers have been quitting jobs in the United States in recent months than have done so for years. The statistics are off the chart. What's that about? Workers, individually, yes, are deciding they're not going to take the wages, the working conditions, the disrespect, everything that goes with it. You know, they've just come through a year and a half of being told in many cases how essential they were and their work was. Yeah, but their wages didn't show it and their working conditions didn't show it. And they understand that and they're angry. My hope and their future will depend on whether they can move from the individual protest of quitting to the organized union protest of changing the terms that every worker comes to work on. My next update has to do with the so-called competition between the United States and China, a competition about which Mr. Biden and many of his officials talk quite a bit. And I was struck by a recent insight that came to me as I read all of the statements. What China has been able to do up until now has been to grow its economy. The quantity and quality of its goods and services have grown much faster than that of the United States. And likewise, the average wage, even adjusted for prices, of a Chinese worker has gone up much faster than of American workers over several decades now. But there's a new kind of competition coming, and that's going to be even more profound in shaping the contest. And I don't want you to take my word, and I don't want you to take the words of any official in China or of the Chinese government. I'm going to read to you a paragraph published by Bloomberg News. You could not have a more U.S. pro-capitalist source. Here's a recent article from Bloomberg News, and I'm going to read it to you. China's leaders clearly have a vision for what their country should look like. Risks in the financial system should be controlled. Inequality should be reduced. And as recent events have shown, they are committed to making this vision a reality. I'm reading to you from Bloomberg News. Let me continue. For the business world, that could ultimately be a good thing if markets become more stable and prosperity more widespread. But in the short term, building that vision will entail a fair amount of pain for some of the country's biggest companies. This week alone, authorities ordered all food delivery companies, Meituan being the largest, to ensure they pay their couriers at least the minimum wage and help them with health care and pensions. Shares of Meituan slumped last Monday and Tuesday before staging a bit of a comeback. They likewise banned for-profit tutoring corporations because they widen the rich-poor gap. What will happen, Bloomberg asks, to the competition between U.S. and China if the country not only grows faster than the U.S., but also reduces inequality vis-a-vis the U.S.? That might be the most important component in determining the outcome of the competition. Think about it. My next update has to do with something called the Right to Repair movement in the United States. This is a movement that is angry and targets corporations. Perhaps the most important, Apple, which has such a remarkable reputation despite behaving in this kind of way. Here's what the Right to Repair movement is about. More and more companies, particularly those that make electronic devices of one kind or another, are refusing to make available the information needed to repair the device they produce and sell. What that does is deny the buyer the right, the possibility of repairing his or her own purchased equipment. It denies small independent repair shops any business they could get by repairing what people are buying. And of course, it allows these huge corporations, mostly monopoly or oligopoly corporations, it allows them to charge a fortune, requiring you to get it repaired where they see fit to let you do that, and charging you an arm and a leg. There was a recent story of a Tesla automobile needing repair, and the bill was $16,000. The Right to Repair movement says this is outrageous. This is simply stealing from the mass of people by using your monopoly power to force them to pay excess for what they could and should either be able to do for themselves or get a local repair person to do. The movement for the Right to Repair started in the 1990s. It got going in 2012 when the state of Massachusetts forced something which others have now copied, namely that automobile companies can't play this game. They cannot deny the information so that you can go to a local mechanic rather than paying five times that amount at the dealer, etc., etc. Now, of course, it's still true that these companies sell the equipment to the local repair person, and that can, of course, lead to gouging at the price, but it's at least a step confronting monopolists. And now let me explain, so you see this clearly, what's involved here. I'm going to use several examples. Number one, those of you that have computers and printers know that there's a bizarre moment when you go into any kind of shop that sells ink cartridges. Ink cartridges are a component of every printer. Here's what you see. If you look at the wall of such a shop, you will see literally hundreds of ink cartridges. Each printer company makes its own. Those cannot be used in any other printer, and no other cartridge can be used. In this way, the printer companies can force us to pay way more than we could if this were standardized, if there were three or four or five basic alternatives and all the machines could use all of them. If you think that's weird, let me give an example where that already exists. Here it is. It's gasoline. You don't have to worry about filling up your gas tank, do you? You can go into the gas station of any company, any of the big ones, the little ones too, and fill up. It's a standardized product. It doesn't have to be. If Exxon could get together with the Chevrolet company, they could make sure that you couldn't put anything in your Chevrolet tank except Exxon gas. You'd have to go to an Exxon station, and they could charge you pretty much what they wanted because you couldn't go anywhere else. That's basically the same game. President Biden has now secured a unanimous vote by the Federal Trade Commission to require large corporations to provide instructions, enabling both consumers and small repair operations to fix all gadgets, large and small, not just automobiles. Other countries have gone, as so often happens now, much further than the United States. France has an exemplary system of securing, with the state support, the right to repair. And what is the big tech companies doing? What are Apple and the others doing? Threatening. They don't want their monopoly privilege to be taken away. And they're threatening, gee, if you fix it yourself or if you have a local person fix it for you, well, we may not honor the warranty and we may claim that anything that goes wrong, well, that's your fault or the repair. They're threatening as they always do. They're using the extra money they make by overcharging for repairs to make sure that they're the only ones who can make the repairs in the future. We've come to the end of the first part of today's show. And as always, I want to thank all of you whose support makes this show possible each week. In particular, we'd like to thank our Patreon community and other regular monthly supporters. If you haven't already, please go to patreon.com/economic update or visit democracyatwork.info to learn more about how you can get involved in supporting this show. Please remember to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you're watching this on YouTube, please hit the red subscribe button below. Stay with us. We'll be right back with today's special guest, investigative reporter and author Bob Henley. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's Economic Update. It is with special pleasure that I bring back to our microphones and cameras someone who has been here before, but not quite in this capacity. This is Bob Henley. And I want to remind you not only that Bob Henley is a remarkable reporter in the old style, a real investigative reporter who digs out the news that we need to hear, even if it's sometimes hard to do it. But he appears with us this time not only as a reporter with an acute sense of what's going on, as I think you many of you know, but also as the author of a new book. So let me thank you, first of all, Bob, for joining us, and then let me give you the proper introduction you deserve.
Bob is
an award-winning print and broadcast journalist. He's now a reporter with The Chief Leader, a New York City-based newspaper covering unions since 1897. Bob also contributes regularly to Salon with stories on the economy and politics. He has worked in the past, and this is quite a list, CBS's 60 Minutes, The New York Times, The Village Voice, The Christian Science Monitor, CBS Money Watch, National Public Radio, WNYC, and the Pacifica Network. He's recently been covering the pandemic through the perspective of healthcare workers, first responders, and the entire workforce that is called essential. And he has a new book just released and published by yours truly, the Democracy at Work team. The title of his book, Stuck Nation, Can the United States Change Course on Our History of Choosing Profits Over People. It's available at www.democracyatwork.info/books. Personally, I could not recommend a better book to understand what we're doing and living through than this one, and that's why we published it. So let's begin, Bob. You've called your book Stuck Nation. Tell us, what does it mean? Why did you choose that title? How are we stuck?
I guess Stuck Nation goes back to when I was at WNYC at the back end of the second Obama term. I had been a reporter covering local events in the New York, New Jersey metro region and expanded nationally. I had covered with some detail the rise to power of Barack Obama. I had the chance to have a relatively lengthy interview with him when he was still Senator Obama. I, like so many Americans, was impressed by his extemporaneous grasp of geopolitical issues. I did have a kind of foreshadowing at the time that his answer, particularly on the question of our need to move away from our law enforcement adversarial approach when it came to drug abuse to a public health response, that response showed me that he was a kind of telegenic moderate, but not really a radical change agent. Over the period of time of the years that followed, where I was doing granular reporting in communities like Patterson, Newark, Cleveland, Philadelphia, I saw that what was happening is that the rape of Martin Luther King Boulevard and of Main Street by Wall Street banks, I call them new pirates of the Caribbean, had actually accelerated under President Obama. And what was happening is that while African Americans got the historical bragging rights of having the first African American in the White House, so many of them were losing their own homes. So I became aware that really this country was stuck, because even when rhetorically the issues were identified by even Democratic leadership, the forces of capital continued to undermine the circumstance of the American people here in the United States and indeed around the world, even as our planetary situation through global warming continued to deteriorate at an accelerating rate.
All right, Bob, let me move on. We're about to, or we're in the midst of, depending on your perspective, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, a rather momentous historical moment. Do you think the events then, in some way, played a role in getting the U.S. stuck now? And if so, how do you see the connection?
Wow, I think we can answer that on at least a couple of levels. Internationally, the response that happened was for the United States to squander the goodwill of the world, because in the global narrative, we had been attacked. And so we used that as an opportunity to create this further notice war on terror, which we continue to pursue. And in the process, set off a mass migration crisis on a scale not seen since the Second World War, with all kinds of deadly consequences for humanity. And then at the same time, at the granular level, where the attack actually happened, and that's where I've been privileged and honored to serve for 5 years, reporting in Lower Manhattan about the consequences of what happened to working people and essential workers in the aftermath of 9/11, and indeed the tens of thousands of Lower Manhattan students and community members, even folks in Western Brooklyn, throughout the whole region, really. Because what happened was, and this presaged what's happened with the Trump response to the pandemic, in the immediate aftermath of the attack, where 16 acres was laid to waste, the EPA, under the direction of President George Bush, with Christy Todd Whitman as the EPA head, advised people the air was safe to breathe within a couple of days. And at the time, the thought was, it's important to show the world that the United States could not be laid low by a terrorist attack. And Wall Street was what is in close proximity there. So tens of thousands of people from around the world, but a heavy concentration for this tri-state region, spent months on top of what was a huge unprecedented funeral pyre, where they were digging for relatives, colleagues, and coworkers under the belief, which was a lie, that the air was safe to breathe. The fires continued to burn for a period of time. The city of New York ordered some 19,000 school children back into schools within the area that was toxic, which included portions of Western Brooklyn and things south of schools south of Houston. And so as a consequence, later on, we learned from the EPA Inspector General that the EPA had actually suppressed information that showed the air was like, you know, Drano. And subsequently, what resulted was we now have more people that have died from occupational exposures and tens of thousands of people, some 50,000 people, who are involved with long-term healthcare concerns through the World Trade Center health program. This is a narrative that has been largely lost. And as you see with the rise of Mayor Giuliani, this was something he did on his watch, where he made a calculation that it was more important to operate Wall Street and get Lower Manhattan up and running than think about the long-term health consequences. So now, the city of New York and the teachers' unions and other unions are trying to find some 19,000 young people. And there's a group called Sty Health, which was started by a visionary young woman, Nyla Nordstrom, because these kids need to be advised, who are now young adults, that they have a health exposure. There have been some that have died as a consequence. So this really mirrors what's happened with the pandemic, in the sense that we've been told that there was nothing to worry about. We were told all kinds of things happened in terms of guidance from the CDC that turned out to be erroneous, whether it was using masks that should be used for one clinical encounter, an N95 mask. Nurses, when the CDC concerned about inventory control, said, no, forget what you've learned in nursing school, forget what you've learned in med school, but use your mask across encounters. The nurses warned two things would happen, Rick. One, that they would die as a result of the exposure, and that hospitals would become a vector for the disease. both things happened. Similarly, we see now in May, when the CDC ordered the lifting of the universal mask mandate, even for people vaccinated in public interior settings, the very same unions begged for them to wait, because we saw that that decision left behind millions of Americans for a myriad of reasons who are not vaccinated. As we speak today, the CDC has retracted that guidance and is now echoing exactly the same concerns raised by public health professionals and the union movement.
For you, these are signs of a nation that's stuck. And I want to give you a chance to go back and show us that link.
Well, I think what's happened in our politics is that I would say going back, and this is your scholarship that we're building on, of course, because you've identified roughly since the 70s that America's economy really stopped working for the broad base of people. What we saw was productivity through technology really advanced the ability of people to create wealth. But what happened was, and this is borne out by the Economic Policy Institute, any number of mainstream economists will tell you that that wealth went to the top increasingly. And that through a bipartisan coalition of both parties, the United States government, our representative government, became the concierge for multinational capital. We actually came to believe that the function of the United States was the preservation of large amounts of capital. That was job one. Anything else like public health was secondary. And as a consequence, as people who are regular listeners to Economic Update understand, we ignored the dashboard that was inconvenient. For 3 years running, life expectancy declined in the United States. The only time that happened was before the last great mass death event during the Spanish flu outbreak. And so we have consistently ignored the circumstances of the American people by putting a kind of veneer of patriotism that we're exceptional, which denies us of the situational awareness that we're not.
Okay. Bob, what would it take, in your judgment, to get us unstuck? And before you answer, I'd like to draw on your knowledge, because you've covered the labor movement, you've covered labor unions, you've focused on them. What would it take to get us unstuck? And what do you imagine or hope might be the role of the labor movement in getting us unstuck?
Well, I would say that in the book, we have conversations with Sarah Nelson, who leads the flight attendant CWA, Reverend Barber, Cornel West, and many other leaders of the labor movement and the social justice movement. And I would say of faith-based groups, because I identify, full disclosure, as a Dorothy Day Catholic. That's who I am. And so what's happened is that we're seeing, and the 9/11 response of the first responders and the broader community, the faith community, the labor movement, is why there's a World Trade Center health program, right? That's something that we accomplished and even got reactionary Republicans to join in bipartisan support. So at least those brave souls that responded to help rebuild Lower Manhattan have health care. That is the result of the kind of organizing I'm talking about. Similarly, we see Reverend Barber making the connection between the need for us to embrace the low-wage, low-wealth workforce that has been closed out of politics as a continuation of the discrimination of Jim Crow, and that the labor movement, as certain portions of it did, needs to identify strongly with Reverend Barber's movement, the Poor People's Campaign, as elements of it did during Martin Luther King's era. Because the redemption of America's promise is embedded in keeping those promises. And so I see a multifaceted movement rooted where we live by establishing conversations we haven't had before, by being brave enough to see the history that's distorted by what happened to the Native American people through the doctrine of Christian discovery and the legacy of slavery, owning those original sin, and at the same time, building a new covenant in the workplace that puts workers first and the public interest.
Do you think we can get unstuck as a nation?
I remain optimistic, because one of the things is that every day as a reporter, the definition of news is that I go out each day and get educated by the workforce. And so I think part of the problem is the people in my business act as if we've seen it all. And so we are oblivious to change.